Hello and welcome to the podcast that loves its banter so much we'll be spending a large part of it discussing a pair of tits as Sky throw away the keys after their lead anchors caught offside. We're also indulging in some cupping action with the Carling, Asian and FA Cups on the agenda. Yes, we're more dangerous than a Kevin Muscat challenge. This is the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Hello, this is the Two Footed Tackle podcast. I am Gary Andrews, and on this week's pod, a man who hasn't been seen in these parts for quite some time, Two Footed Tackle editor Chris Nee. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hello, you're back from Germany, was it last week?
Yes, it was Germany last week, and after a lengthy winter break for the pod itself, so very pleased to be back. Slightly odd surroundings, I think we can safely say.
Yes,
it's... But good to be back on.
Different from our other studio. Did you bring any breakfast back with you?
No, I didn't. It was a flying visit. I barely ate anything at all. And what I did was at the headquarters of a well-known company that isn't as German as it once was.
Okay. No, I don't really care about the company. I was just interested in the breakfast, schnitzel, etc.
Next time.
Excellent. Okay. Also on the pod this week, a welcome return to the Two Footed Tackle podcast for the lovely Jess Elvidge. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Gary.
Hello, great to have you here. And also, on the food note, you were waiting on about burgers last night. Burgerette.
Yes, so I'm straight out of shift at London's hottest dive bar / burger joint, which has popped up while I've been away. So I was a burgerette for the evening, the correct term.
Excellent.
Is.
Okay, burgerette, which is kind of like, good, you know, given that we're talking Sky Sports at various points, our equivalent to the soccerette, really.
Yes, I was the soccerette of a dive bar in New Cross.
Wonderful.
Nice.
Finally, the man, the legend that is Mr. James Avell.
Hi, Gary.
Hello, James. Any food stuff for us this week, given the theme that's around there or not?
Well, no. I've not been a burgerette and I haven't eaten any bratwurst.
Shame. Oh, well, that's it. Let's crack on in. Okay, let's start with a nice Carling cuppa. And on that note, Chris, I guess that Birmingham's victory over West Ham in the Carling Cup last night took the biscuit for you.
Yes, it did. I'm pleased to say that West Midlands Police can finally have a day off when there's a football match because it will be in London.
Okay, not happy about Blues getting through then?
No, I think they're probably... quite well set up for cup football in the way that they're playing, the way they're really well organised. And it's difficult to say that they don't deserve to be in the final, but I can't really say I'm that pleased for them, to be honest. I certainly don't want to see them win it, but deserved appearance in the final.
It was a very good match. I guess kind of you guys probably all caught more highlights. I watched it, obviously wasn't there, but sat and watched it. West Ham really could have done a lot better. They went at it first half really well. Looked like they were going to... Well, they could have had a couple, and then they've got an extra goal, so 2-goal cushion over the aggregate, and then just sat back and defended. And once Birmingham got one, there was an inevitability about it, you have to say. But James, I mean, Avram Grant, he seems to be quite a cup manager, but and can sort of do it over one game or can sort of get a good 45 minutes out of West Ham. He just can't get a full league schedule, I guess, out of them.
Well, I don't think getting a good 45 minutes out of West Ham sort of made him a cup manager.
I mean, he's had a good cup run with West Ham in the Carling Cup.
Yeah,
he had a good cup run with Portsmouth last season in the FA Cup.
No, you're absolutely right. It's interesting because you sort of assume on that basis that he would be really sort of good at getting his team ready for a big relegation run in. He can just say to his players, you know what, treat every game as a cup match. It's, you know, win or bust every time. And if that's how he sets up his team for a cup game, then surely the next 10 or so Premier League fixtures, you've got to say that they're going to be well set for it. But the way they capitulated last night, I mean, the way that Craig Gardner was given so much room for that third goal, it was as if when he picked the ball up, it was kind of... I was looking to see where the West Ham back line was, and they're all standing on the edge of the area, and he's, you know, 40 yards out. It was a very strange bit of defending, and to have lost the game from the position that they did is a real knockout blow. And I think that no matter Avram Grant's abilities in cup competitions or what have you, or one-off games, this is a serious test of their mettle.
He's lost his distraction now as well, so his league form is going to make or break his West Ham career now, because there isn't the prospect of a Wembley trip on the horizon.
I mean, we discussed Avram Grant's Wembley career on the pod last week, and West Ham career on the pod last week, and I don't think that anything's particularly changed. I'm sure that they're going to look at a replacement, whatever happens at the end of the season. But you're right, it would have been nice for him to get a Wembley trip out of him before they do give him his P45 in June.
Interesting. I can't remember the exact stat, but I think majority of West Ham's goals that they've conceded have come in the box, as they all did last night as well, which, you know, it points to some serious issues defence-wise. But, you know, if you're just losing it in the penalty area, it's not good at all.
I don't know what their defensive lineups have been for the last few weeks, but we spoke in one of the very early pods in the season. We looked at the defensive lineups that they've had, and in the first few games, they've been through about 9 defenders. So there's no continuity there then, and if they still haven't settled, then they're going to concede goals like that.
All from set pieces and such like. The other one, Birmingham will face Arsenal, who overcame Ipswich in the semi-final. Jess, you were at the Emirates.
I was.
I didn't actually see the game, so how did Arsenal do in there? Was it a tough battle? Because Ipswich held out for quite a long time.
They did hold back for a long time, and the first half was a little bit tough. Well, certainly on the crowd, mentally, I think. The mood was at a few bad refereeing decisions, and it gets to that kind of stage which Arsenal get to a lot when they're not when they're being frustrated by a team. But Ipswich were really very good, and they did challenge it quite a lot in the first half, and deep into the second half actually. But in the end, actually, the second half was much better. Really, really enjoyable. It was really good to. Really good to watch, actually. So I was watching it from the North Bank, and it was fantastic.
Was it kind of a question of Ipswich raising the game to quite a high level, or was it more Arsenal just were a bit below par until they finally got that goal in the second half? I mean, this is over two legs, really, you could probably say.
Yeah, so I actually missed the first leg because I was in India, so I'm catching up at the moment on quite a lot. So I couldn't really say about the first leg performance. I've heard that it was pretty disastrous. But it seemed that they just kind of got themselves regrouped after half time, got themselves together, and actually, got everything together and put a performance out, really. It was very good to watch.
How we talk about Wenger wanting a trophy, and it seems that this one he's decided he's definitely going to have a stab at. As an Arsenal fan, how happy are you that he's actually putting out stronger strength sides? He's not blooding the kids. I mean, is that a good or a bad thing for you? I mean, he's famously used it. We've seen a lot of kids come through, but now he's clearly going for it.
Yeah, so that was the kind of theme for the last few years. And to be fair to them, they've all played incredibly, incredibly well. But I think not so much just like the Carling Cup this year. I think Wenger is very much persistent in going all out in all competitions. And whenever you hear him talk about it, he's always saying that he's got huge priorities for basically decimating the opposition in every single one of the competitions. So I don't know what's actually, come alive in him, really. I don't see too much of a change, but it's kind of seems to be coming through this year. Which is, it's very pleasing.
I guess as an Arsenal fan, you'd happily take any kind of silverware that's on offer. That's not meant in a derogatory way, but, you obviously, when there's a cup on offer.
I think it would help, but particularly the kind of a lot of people who are very questioning about this issue of silverware. I mean, I'm not so one of these people that's necessarily clamouring for it and thinking that it's absolutely essential. I really enjoy watching Arsenal play and develop, and I do see, I have probably a lot more of the way that Wenger sees it, like the future potential of the squads that he's had. There's certainly a lot of fans out there that are kind of getting on his back for the fact that there hasn't been any silverware. And I think that's a bit of a difficult position to take, really. I think they've perhaps forgotten that they've been quite spoiled in not so recent history now, but certainly compared to sides in the past.
Yes, George Graham signs in terms of watching from back in the day. Obviously, the final hasn't happened yet. Chris, putting aside your club loyalties, do you think Birmingham could have a chance against Arsenal? Because Arsenal will obviously go into that game as favourites.
They've got a chance. They've got the same sort of chance as Villa did against Man United last year, and they could potentially frustrate Arsenal and they could nick it. But I think Arsenal will ultimately be too good, just in the way that United had a few players who stood out and were able to beat us with them last year.
Well, it depends whether they get an early penalty turned down or not.
Well, we got the penalty. The red card was staggeringly missing, though.
Yes, I thought I just put a lot in to get you a little bit more animated, Chris. Yeah,
thanks. I really wanted to remember that moment.
That's what we do best on the pod.
Out.
Okay, right. Moving a bit further abroad, there were other semi-finals this week, doing lots of cups in this first half. Japan and Australia have reached the final of the Asian Cup. It's been an interesting tournament. James, the Aussies, particularly impressive. They absolutely destroyed Uzbekistan in their semi-final.
Yeah, it was 6-0, six different scorers, which is always nice. I was glued to Al Jazeera watching that one a couple of days ago. Honestly, I was. And the Aussies look pretty set for the Asian Cup, I think. And it's obviously only their second Asia Cup since they joined the AFC. So I'm not sure whether that is suggestive of the Aussies' strength or the weakness of the Confederation, or maybe a mixture of two of the both. But either way, probably a good final as well, because Japan, they performed quite well in the World Cup, and they've got a few really excellent players. So I might even tune back to Al Jazeera for that one as well.
I certainly will probably do as well. I mean, when you mentioned sort of the weakness, or perhaps, you don't know, of the region. When you look at the semi-finalists, Australia probably aren't surprised. South Korea and Japan, again, not surprised. They're the big hitters. Was it perhaps a surprise to see Uzbekistan reach the semi-finals?
Well, you look at the teams that you would ordinarily regard as sort of regional powerhouses, and you're kind of looking at Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iran and Saudi Arabia certainly have been pretty much consistent World Cup qualifiers. And they've, for whatever reason, I can't say that I'm sure why that is, have really declined in recent years. And Uzbekistan definitely are on the rise. There's definitely political will. We've talked on the pod a little bit about the club side, Bunyodkor, whose kind of stated ambition is to spend as much money as possible on people like Zico and Rivaldo to kind of propel them into kind of household name territory. And I think that that's a similar thing that's going on in Uzbek football, though they're not, at the national level, they're not importing talent in the way that you might anticipate. They're not a kind of Qatar handing out visas and passports left, right and centre. They've actually tried to build from within. And if you look at their squad, they really have only one big name player, a guy called, and this is obscure even by my obscure measures, there's a guy called Maxim Shatsky, who used to play, still plays in the Ukrainian league for Arsenal Kiev, but had a really good, around the time of the Rebrov Shevchenko era and Dynamo Kiev, was playing in the Dynamo Kiev team then, and he's really Uzbekistan's outstanding player. And the rest of their team, there's only three in their Asia Cup squad that are over the age of 30, so they're still up and coming. And I'm not necessarily surprised that with the fall of Iran and Saudi Arabia and the other kind of regional bigger sides, that a team like Uzbekistan, who've got a lot of capital and investment going on, are able to get to the semi-finals.
Certainly interesting. I watched Japan actually quite a few times in this tournament, and they've been brilliantly entertaining, if not quite the Japan I'd expected at all. Certainly their semi-final with South Korea was something quite special, with the flowing back and forth. And even their quarter-final against Qatar was very, very entertaining. Qatar made a really good account of themselves, and I think it probably impressed a lot of people in this tournament, given that, well, there's not an awful lot of Qataris actually in that squad, and given where they're going in the next few years. But Chris, I know you're a big fan of Japan as well as a team.
Yes, I do have a little bit of a Japan fixation after the World Cup. So delighted to see them in the final. I kind of tipped them to get a long way into the tournament. And they'll be looking to repeat what they did to Australia in the first time Australia played England. They knocked them out in the quarterfinals, I believe. So Australia will have nightmares about that one. But, of course, Shinji Kagawa is going to be a big miss for them, as he will for Dortmund. So I personally think Australia are probably favourites, and I certainly wouldn't have said that if I thought this was the final at the start of the competition. I think Japan are very strong. They obviously haven't quite fulfilled what their expectations would have been at the start of the competition. They've still battled their way through to the final. So who knows what they might be able to do, but I think on the strength of their semi-final, Australia have to be favourites.
In terms of the tournament as a whole, Chris, it's perhaps one that hasn't really registered that much. Obviously, the African Cup of Nations is a tournament that a lot of people are now getting really into. I've seen a few very good games in this. Do you think, especially now with Qatar having got the World Cup in 11 years' time now, do you think this kind of, now people are looking to the Asian region, do you think it's the Asian Cup next time around could be, have potential to be even more big, more watched around the world? Or do you think it's just one of those ones that we're just still gasping for some more international football after a slightly average World Cup?
No, I think it will grow and grow. Qatar has been a driving factor this time around. If people have enjoyed it, they'll probably watch the next one as well. I think the fact that a lot of these countries are now beginning to export players in numbers to the big European leagues. And I think the likes of South Korea and Japan performing well on the world stage is probably driving a few viewers for this as well. And having an Anglophone country in the age of social media probably isn't going to do it any harm either. So I can't see any reason why it won't be bigger next time around.
One last thing, because Jess, well, before we started recording, you were out in India during the tournament. And I was just curious, because you said that India just didn't seem to really have much interest in football. They obviously were in the Asian Cup, but you probably wouldn't have known it while you were out there.
No, so we did make a bit of an effort to try and pick up English language newspapers and watch a bit of the TV while we were out there. And they do have an incredible number of sports channels out there. But to be honest, they're just so involved in cricket. They basically, there's no real interest in this idea of soccer out there. I mean, I did read a couple of Asia Cup match reports, because I thought, you know, well, while I'm out there, it'd be really interesting to see like how this is represented or how people get into it. But I saw endless guys glued to like India-Pakistan replays from the 90s.
That's their ESPN Classic channel.
Yeah. Well, they've got a cricket classic channel. They've got a cricket news channel, like a Sky Sports News, but just for cricket. It's incredible. And so, yeah, the football kind of gets lost a bit amongst all of that, I'll be honest.
And I guess, like, if you've got that kind of attitude, I mean, India's a big country. Potentially, you go, well, the number of players who they could draw from there. But
yeah, you would think so, but you don't, like, absolutely no children playing cricket. You'll go to a park, and there'll be, like, swathes of space, but in every, like, there'll be people setting up a wicket and setting up a field, you know, like, actually spotting their fielders correctly, and somebody will have set up another wicket, like, 3 metres across, and you'll have all these, like, fielders, like, jostling for space. And you know, there's some, in some places, such extreme poverty out there, and all they have is a cricket bat and ball. It's never a football, which I found was really, really interesting.
Yeah, totally different world.
Yeah.
Totally different world. Okay, to finish off our cup hat trick for this part, very, very quick look at the FA Cup fourth round this weekend. Jess, any ties that have caught your eye? I do have a list over here if you haven't.
Well, there's one in particular that's caught my eye, and Chris is going to love this game. This is Birmingham playing Cove.
Oh dear.
Being a Coventry girl myself, I'm kind of relishing that one. Cove have always been all right in the cup, and it's very nostalgic for me, the idea of watching Coventry play in the FA Cup. So I'm looking forward to that a lot. Obviously, the Arsenal Huddersfield match is an interesting one for me as well, because I'm always a massive fan of an underdog. So
it's also proper like 1920s football, is Arsenal Huddersfield.
Yeah.
It's like, you should just rename the teams like the Wanderers and, you know,
be done with it.
I'm just so looking forward to like the scores being, the post-match announcements. Arsenal and Huddersfield.
No, it's good. It's great. Yeah, that's what the FA Cup is all about.
Yeah, it is,
that
absolutely.
And, that and giant killings and other cliches.
Chris, you're not overly happy with Villa's draw, I'm guessing. Another game against Blackburn.
It's something like our ninth game against Blackburn in two seasons, because we've drawn them in both cups, both years. And they've got a decent record over us in the league lately, but we've won every single cup game, including both legs of the League Cup semi-final. So I wasn't too chuffed when the balls came out, which we'll touch on in part two, no doubt. But actually thinking about
not
it...
Not literally we, touch on.
if we can continue our cup run against them, then obviously I'll be delighted to see if we can get in the fifth round, but I think it's going to be very, very tough.
Yeah, I mean, this it's perhaps not sort of a round that particularly grabs you in a lot of the fixtures, James, but there are kind of a few interesting ones. I guess probably from the... One of the talking points, although part of me is loath to mention this, is obviously Torquay Crawley, because two reasonably small teams from Crawley, last non-league team left in. You've got to say it's a great chance for them to get to the fifth round. Not that perhaps too many neutrals will be willing them on.
No, exactly. I think that it's great to see non-league teams going as far as possible. And you know what? If Torquay win, that's still a League Two team in the fifth round, so, and that doesn't happen all that often either. So either way, I suppose there's enough for the media types like myself to feed off. I also, by the way, talking of big needle matches, I'd be interested to watch West Ham against Nottingham Forest. Now, perhaps not for the reasons you might expect, but and apologies to those of you who don't live in London listening in, who don't know what I'm talking about, but every single tube line going to West Ham on Saturday is going to be shut. So I don't think there's going to be an enormous crowd there. I think that basically everyone's going to give up. Like, West Ham fans are already on the floor after being knocked out of the League Cup semi-finals and in the relegation zone. And they won't even be able to get to Upton Park on Saturday without some kind of horrific bus, train, taxi, horse-drawn cart combination. So, I'd keep an eye out for a lot of angry, miserable-looking Hammers fans.
That's a fairly common sight these days.
Yeah, exactly.
I think just to go back to Crawley, I think actually, unfortunately, most neutrals will be cheering them on.
I guess it's kind of the informed neutral and the uninformed neutral. If you don't know the history of Crawley or recent years, or recent months, you probably go, yeah, go on the non-league side. But to those who actually have spent any time around the non-league game and have had to listen to Steve Evans's post-match interviews and what have you, they're not an overly likeable team, are they?
No, good old lovable Bruce and Susan, eh?
Yeah, well done for them for funding it.
I quite fancy Stevenage to beat Reading at home.
Yeah, that's not a bad shout. They've had a very good run. Graham Westley, again, is very good at getting teams up for a one-off game, and obviously they'll be flying high. Believe they can beat anybody after the last round.
They will. I quite fancy Southampton Man United as well. That's just a game that will bring the plight of the club into sharp relief after so many classic matches in the 90s between those two teams. Saints fans will be looking on at that one and wishing they were 20 years in the past.
One, just finally on this, one for me that I'm actually would be quite interested in that's perhaps slip under the radar. It's not a glamour tie, but Watford against Brighton, I think, could be one of the most entertaining games of the round. Watford doing surprisingly well, given their resources and I guess novice manager and Malky Mackay in the Championship. Brighton, probably the best team I've seen in League One this season. I've seen them a few occasions and they've been fantastic. I think you're going to get a beautiful, flowing, open attacking game there.
I know a few people are going to that one for that very reason.
Yeah, it could be, you know, so if there's any spare tickets at Watford, going at Watford and you happen to be in that area, that's a game to be at, I would predict. It's happened probably 0-0 now I said that. Okay, we'll probably no doubt go into the FA Cup in a bit more detail next podcast. Let's take a short break, allow the pod time to swat up, because after the break, I'll be asking if you can do better than Andy Gray and understand the offside rule.
Twofootedtackle.com.
Hello and welcome. Part two of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Before we got onto the football, we had quite a response to James's anecdote about seeing Gary McAllister in a soup shop last week, which I think is possibly the best thing we've ever had on the Two-Footed Tackle pod. I do not exaggerate there at all. We had a flurry of tweets and anecdotes about mundane footballer meetings. I thought I'd share some of the best ones we've got here. So hold on to your stomachs on this one. Catherine Wilson has said, I saw Jim the Bald Eagle Smith in his Speedos in Florida about 10 years ago. There's a sight. Damon TH said he saw Mark Crossley at Palmer Airport wearing his Forest shorts. Company man, always good to see, keeping it wherever he goes. JHBHQ once played cricket with Ian Hendon and took his middle stump out.
I hope that's not a euphemism.
Well, so do I sincerely hope not, especially given what we're getting onto in this part. Mark Curtins went to college with Jerry Taggart's sister and said that Jerry Taggart's sister looks slightly worryingly like Jerry Taggart.
Gosh, that gives Jim Smith and his speedos a run for its money.
It does. And just finally, Zinedine F. Said, this is probably my favourite one, the best day of my life, I once sold Lionel Perez an ice cream. Which I think is absolutely brilliant.
Top notch.
What kind of ice cream?
It was a strawberry split, apparently.
Strawberry split?
If we're talking mundane, that definitely takes it all, doesn't it? It's top stuff.
Have you got any, Chris?
Mine are all really rubbish, because they're all Bournemouth players.
Well, no. Carry on.
I say all. I once saw Brian Stock in Pizza Hut.
Okay. Was this the same one that he got chucked out for the cause of racism?
Yes, it was the same Pizza Hut, yes. Okay. It was a long time ago,
okay.
When he was at Bournemouth, so a little while ago. But it was the same branch. Anyone remember Ian Cox? I think he's played for Burnley and maybe Reading and Bournemouth.
Centre-half. Rings the bell,
right.
Sort of.
He was a good player. He nearly ran me over.
Okay.
But I mean, that's about it, really. A few other Bournemouth players around town. I used to take the piss out of James Beattie in a nightclub on a regular basis.
Oh, that's a duty.
We prank called him a bit after the FA Cup final in 2005. Well.
Wow.
How'd you get his number?
Yeah, I'm intrigued in that.
Friend of a friend.
You admit to
him. But I'm not going to say that because it's libelous.
Fair enough. You talk about getting run over. A friend of a friend once got run over by a taxi that had Tyrone from Coronation Street in the back of it.
Are you holding Tyrone responsible for that?
The guy was fine. Interestingly, when I then went up to Manchester, all gone out together and everything, and we went into a chip shop after going out to the club, and Tyrone from Coronation Street was in there. So the guy went, "Hi, Tyrone, do you remember me?" It's like, "Yeah, you're the." I had to wait half an hour for while they cleared you off the road last week.
Oh, which was nice guy.
Very nice. I'm sure he's probably calmed down a bit.
Well, we can slag him off, but we've all just laughed at someone getting run over.
Jess, anything? Yeah. Any great footballer meet? Oh, Coronation Street, actually.
Well, Coronation Street, no, not so much of that in the Midlands, unfortunately.
Okay.
I did used to see Gordon Strachan walking his dogs quite regularly.
Okay.
That was back when he was at Cov. Going, yeah, not really a footballer, quite mundane though.
What do you mean not really a footballer? One of the finest footballers to play for Leeds United.
I say not really a footballer, he was a manager at the time. So he was quite a figurehead in the city. And he used to be like, kind of take the dogs out and be very much part of the community. It was quite nice.
Like Roy Keane, take the dogs out, like negate the community. Ignore the community.
Take the dogs out to take the community out.
I think those poor dogs, you know, and they must have known whenever Keane came back, like after a bad day at work, they're just like, oh god, right, start up the treadmill, get warmed up.
Stretch off.
Yeah.
Those calves are supple. It's going to be a long day.
I do also have one more that's actually, it's quite mundane, but it's actually quite a good footballer spot, this one.
Okay.
And I did actually once see David Beckham eating a bacon and egg sandwich on the table opposite me.
Wow.
That was quite cool.
Where was that?
That was in Heathrow Terminal 5.
Oh, so it wasn't a homemade bacon egg sandwich, because I can't imagine Victoria frying eggs and bacon.
It was a Gordon Ramsay made, actually. Quite swanky. It's a Gordon Ramsay restaurant in Heathrow Terminal 5. And he was there, and just pretty nonchalant, to be honest. Looking quite cool.
And he looked like the kind of guy who eats a bacon and egg sandwich pretty much every day.
You know, yeah, in a nonchalant manner.
In a very nonchalant manner. And he was wearing a hat indoors, though. Bit weird.
Footballers. Disgraceful.
Terrible.
Crazy. So, if you can top David Beckham beating a bacon and egg sandwich, or if you've bumped into a footballer dog walking, or even if you prank called James Beattie, do let us know. podcast@twofootedtackle.com if you want to get in touch, or you can just tweet me, Jay Football, or Chris @twofootedtackle. And let us know your mundane footballer anecdotes, because this has possibly been my favourite part of the pod, and I don't think we're going to top it. But while we're on that, let's have a bit more banter. Yes, the B word, because I know Chris loves it so much.
The B word that used to mean something before students on ski trips got hold of it and made it a different word for fun.
Your gap year.
I believe it's even kind of morphed into, if you're having a chat and bantering as Richard Keys did with Sean Massey over the telephone. Ooh. It's actually chanter. It's chanter these days.
Chanter.
So yeah. I listened to the Keys interview and I thought that it had become enjoying banter, which is what he repeatedly referred to them doing.
Yeah, that's the verb. You enjoy banter. You don't say banter or speak banter. You enjoy it. Because there's only one way to have banter, and it's in an enjoyable way. Sorry, Gary, continue your intro. We stopped at the first pun. And there's four more to go.
I think the semantics of bantering are a perfectly valid topic for discussion at the moment. The Sky Sports main anchors, I would make a joke, but using an extra W, but I think The Guardian got there already yesterday. Sky Sports main anchors have both resigned, as we all know, following sexist comments made about assistant referee Sean Massey, subsequent videos showing further incriminating evidence on Richard Keys and Andy Gray. Okay, we're going to send one member of the pod off to make the tea while we discuss the big issues of the day. So that's milk and no sugar, please, Chris. Jess, what's your take on it? Do you think this whole incident, do you think it shows that sexism is still rife within football?
I actually think it's a really difficult one, and I've been thinking kind of quite a lot about it. I think, to me, there's obviously like a huge issue. Like the main issue for me is that somebody in such a position like Andy Gray or Richard Keys could make such a comment that would potentially influence people to think that a female referee would do a worse job than some of the people that we already have out there, which is absolutely ridiculous. I'm not concerned. I think it was already like plainly obvious that there was so much that working in that sort of industry that you would come across not so much sexism but just idiot men like that. You know, that girls are kind of used to that anyway. You do kind of find them everywhere, and everybody knew already that if you worked in a position such as that, then you'd be exposed to far more of them. That so much is like, it's kind of a secondary issue to me, because I think that girls are quite used to it, and also that any girl going into that sort of environment to work, you're going to have to be quite thick-skinned anyway.
As for football itself,
as for football in general, well, I actually have never really had a problem until this week, and it was quite. It was quite a case of bad timing, really, because I've always gone to the sport, and I've always really enjoyed the sport, and I've like always found that I got on so well with every single person that I met, and there was absolutely no problems. Like, maybe a little bit of light banter here and there, but never anything.
Not that word again.
But never any suggestion that I wouldn't understand football.
Enjoyable banter.
Yeah, so just enjoyable banter that was kind of, you know, like the kind of stuff that you just get with, like, the guys talking to guys would have, you know? It was never really a suggestion that I would not have the correct opinion about football. It was always listened to. Until I was at the football this week, and I was stood in front of the most offensive man I've ever come across in my entire life, who used words that I can't possibly repeat in front of anyone. Just consistently, once every 10 seconds, like, no comment about the football, and I just, like, the bunch of us together just thought, well, you know, he was being, like, and he had this particular tirade against women, like, really, really sexually offensive tirade, and a couple of us turned around and were like, you know, calm it down, it's a bit ridiculous, like, it's unlike anything I've ever heard of the football before, and, yeah, so I was just met with that, with a ridiculous, like, come off it, love. Where's your passion for the game? He's the one that's got the passion. Or do you not? Why are you here? Why would you be here? Are you not enjoying yourself, love? Why don't you go home? And that was the first time I'd really come across it. And I really thought, wow, that is a bit of a horrible coincidence for that to happen in 1 week.
Mm. I did my dissertation on women in football, and those types of incidents are becoming rarer and rarer. And there's some stat that I included, it was years ago now, but it was about the amount of money that each sex puts into the game, and I think about a third of it is from women, and something like about a third of people who go to games, I don't know if it's the Premier League or it was in Football League altogether, but it's about a third again, and for fans it's not as much of an issue, I don't think, as it used to be, and certainly the people I interviewed had that opinion, but as people like Jenny Silver will testify, it still exists in once you start to get inside the game itself and into bases like Sky, it still very much exists.
I think this is absolutely the point, and this is obviously, not to do down your experience, which sounds shocking and but nevertheless unusual, in my personal
opinion. I think that was horribly unusual.
We're asking sort of a question here. Does the issue of Keys and Gray suggest that there is a wider issue of sexism in football as a whole? And actually, I think that the reason there's been such a furore, to quote, to use another stupid word that the media use to describe these things, about the Keys and Gray issue, is that it goes totally against the grain of the entire raison d'etre of the Premier League, which is to push an inclusive, pluralistic, kind of, to a degree, sanitised form of the game onto everybody as a consumer and not as a kind of fan. So we're distancing ourselves from old fan behaviours like racism, sexism, intolerance, bad language, violence and hooliganism, and we're moving towards this polished, squeaky clean product that everyone can consume and enjoy, be they male, female, black, white, etc. And it's so embarrassing for Sky, who have been the ones at the forefront of pushing that message, that the two people who are their kind of flagship personalities, the two people who've been there since the inception, people have come and gone, you know, from Sky ever since 1992, but Keys and Gray have been the ones there all the time. How embarrassing for them that it's they who have been exposed as the sort of dinosaurs. And I think that's the issue. I think that, if anything, it proves that sexism is, as you say, Chris, becoming a less and less of an issue in football, that there has been this reaction.
Do you think, I mean, because it's quite curious sort of how it came about. I mean, part of me, I don't know if you agree with this, James, thought that the reason, not necessarily the reason they're doing it, of that kind of the banter, if you will, sorry, Chris, we're going to crowbar that in as much as possible, but part of the reason that they were doing it is kind of almost like it felt that it seemed like that's what they kind of expected their audience to be in tune with as well. Okay, they weren't doing it on air, but that's kind of that idea of, you know, we're having a bit of banter about women not playing football. It's kind of what we expect our audience will probably be okay with type thing.
Well, it's important to remember they weren't doing it on air. It wasn't done for the benefit of an audience. It was done for the benefit of themselves, frankly.
But you've got that kind of mindset within an organisation. It's probably thinking, well, you know, it's absorbing. When you're in an organisation, and you know that as well as I do, you kind of absorb how your audience feels, yeah, and that's going to feed into
it. I'm with you on that. And I think that actually, forget the Sean Massey tirade, I think that actually what really reflected that was the Andy Gray, Charlotte Jackson, tuck this in love comment. Which, you know, in any workplace, like, forget that he's about to go on TV and think about that as an office, right? In any workplace, you make a comment like that and you run the risk of being sacked. And I don't care if you're Andy Gray, £1.7 million a year. You know, that is a dangerous comment to make to a female co-worker.
That's what did for him in the end, isn't it?
Absolutely,
it was that clear,
right?
What did for him.
Because that's the thing that's actually against the terms of his contract.
Mm.
Well... So I don't know about the off-air comments, but
so actually, maybe you're right that is the ethos of the organisation, that is the kind of thing that was, because you know you've got to say that can't be a one-off. It's a one-off that it got caught on camera and put on YouTube, but it ain't a one-off because he felt comfortable to do it, and it didn't seem like anyone really.
It's not like he suddenly turned into a massive sexist overnight after, what, 19 years of broadcasting previously.
No, but you look at the way that Charlotte Jackson responded to that comment. It was, you know, it was like water off a duck's back, suggesting...
It was
just so suggestive of an ethos that's going on in that organisation. But, I mean, that's my personal take on it. That is not to say, by the way, that you can infer from that I believe that Sky is an inherently sexist organisation. I just think that, you know, you're right, that it probably, on the whole does say a lot for the surroundings of that Sky football studio.
It's important to recognise as well that you strip away the football from this. These are two very powerful men who've been in a big company for a long time, and young people coming into to that place are... probably very ambitious, but also probably a little bit green. And they look up to these two blokes. And, you know, they just take a bit of bullying on the chin, probably. Don't know whether, you know, whether it's... We've obviously seen one particular incident of bullying, which is what got Andy Gray sacked in the end. But as you say, it doesn't seem to have been taken in an unusual way. No, when you see the clip.
There are stories that I've heard from people within the industry about the real kind of bullying, kind of almost a sort of frat boy kind of attitude within that particular team. And I can't really go into specifics about this. But there are tales of the big members of that team, Kian Gray in particular, basically treating it as their personal fiefdom. And anybody who was working on that studio floor was liable to be picked on. Those are stories that I've heard. And they're gone now, so it's a chance to maybe change that whole, ethos around.
Footballs. I mean, Jess, do you think there's kind of positives that have come out of this in that actually you can sort of see a lot of people coming out and sort of saying, yes, there's no problem, not that there should have ever been any problems, but almost kind of forcing through a bigger acceptance of female officials and also perhaps encouraging more people, because I think the FA said they'd had a lot of inquiries from women wanting to become officials in the wake of this, and it's actually raised the profile of the game. In a kind of roundabout way, that's got to be a good thing.
I wouldn't say the manner in which it came about was a good thing, but I agree that by raising the profile of female officials, I think it can only be a good thing. I've never heard anybody question the idea of having one beforehand, and certainly all the guys I've spoken to actually said, well, then, she'll probably do a better job. She looks younger, fitter, healthier than some of the people running the line.
Careful now.
Careful.
Let's not talk about her being fitter. The sun did that, and we all know how that ended.
Yeah, so healthier, and she certainly absolutely knows her stuff, which is fantastic. And I'm sure, again, this will be like water off a duck's back to her. I mean, there's absolutely no way that she'd put herself into a position like running the line up and down in front of a stand full of fans. You can imagine that there are still people there. And the way that anybody gets wound up with the referee.
The thing with that is, with football fans, we're collectively mostly idiots, but certainly when we're in the crowd. But Wendy Toms took most fans past all this, so to have key people in the media still banging on about it.
Yeah.
To have Andy Burton sauntering up the touchline to interview Andy Gray saying, female lino today. What? How is that?
Am I allowed to say that Andy Burton must be a cock?
Yes.
You did.
But
I'm no fan of Andy Burton.
Just to amplify your point, Jess, if there's one thing that has massively boosted the profile of female officials and the standing of female officials in the game, it's not only the comment, but her performance actually in the game.
Yeah.
But those two together, what a potent combination that was, because, to be honest, a flawless performance in the wake of the revelation of that particular stupid, kind of crass kind of comment, just only served to underline, the place for women in the game.
Mm.
I think she's refereeing Corby this weekend. I think Corby Eastwood might be, or something like that.
Actually refereeing the match.
Yeah,
I saw her referred to as a demotion. I can't believe they demoted her for this. She's refereeing the game.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really looking out to see how that turns out, because I'd be really interested to see if there was any potential, because of the kind of ridiculous state that, particularly in the Premier League, you get some certain footballers being so offensive to referees. I wonder if there may be potential for women to actually more like diffuse that sort of situation in the same way that men can't get so angry at a woman. I mean, this is very kind of rough ground.
No, I know what you mean, because you've got when you've got Rooney screaming at a referee.
Yeah, you have to think, would he do that to a woman?
Would Di Canio push over a woman?
And would you?
Dad, you don't answer that. Moving on.
But I mean, you can certainly see, and if Rooney did. So, say Charles Massey was refereeing the Manchester United game, sent off Raphael there. Yeah. Rooney started screaming in her face. You can imagine what the reaction
she'd probably
would
have
be
the,
to
the
it.
Spine to actually send him off.
Yeah, she'd probably be one of the people that would actually say, right, you're off for being offensive. And so few people actually do that. Maybe I think it'd be fantastic. Have a proper turnaround. See what happens.
I completely agree. right, almost, yeah, we pretty much have run out of time on that discussion, because we've got loads more to get through. Part three of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast has the Premier League. Hurrah! It's coming up after this.
Two-FootedTackle.com.
Part three of the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Before we get into matters Premier League, a game that really mattered this weekend. Chris, you were at Lewis versus Staines.
I was at the Dripping Pan, the wonderfully named and actually quite wonderful Dripping Pan. Not the best match. It's quite easy to see actually why Lewis have really struggled to pick up any points at all forever.
Blue Square South. You did part of Socrates, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. A little bloggers meet up on tour. Next one's on the 24th of February, by the way, in Vauxhall.
Sorry, that's my little invisible celebration. The thing is, to anybody that is in the London area or even further, Socrates is well worth a trip on the 24th of February. There is kind of an unlimited supply of pies and lots of really great people to talk to. So that in combination suggests that you should make an effort to come.
The pies are exceptionally good.
They are wonderful.
I like that the pies come first, actually. There's a lot of pies. Some people do.
If all the people in there were axe murderers, I would still turn up for the pies.
That is a ringing endorsement indeed.
Anyway.
So, yeah, Chris. Very brief. Finish off with Lewis. But it's charming ground, isn't it, down there? I'm gutted I couldn't make it.
Yeah, they're a lovely club, and they've got a few things going on in terms of community ownership, and Dave Boyle was there, and it should be a really exciting time for them. Obviously, they're getting relegated, but still, the future's quite bright. Although I would suggest they probably should change the goalkeeper.
What kind of sense did you get sort of around the ground in terms of sort of their hopes for the future? Because as you say, they're bottom of the Blue Square South, they're pretty much going down.
There was nothing explicit really about the future, but I think the fact that they seem to be taking what's happening to them on the field at the moment in such good humour, and it certainly were, no heads dropped. They played okay. You can see why they don't score many goals, because they just didn't really have any incision at all. But they played all right for parts. They had one really good chance at the end of the turn around the post. And 1-0 defeat was a fair result, but they certainly didn't disgrace themselves. And I think, they went six or seven defeats in a row or something. So they'll be well in tune with the idea that they're going down. And they seem to be picking themselves up to enjoy the run in and take what's coming to them. And then look to rebuild next year from the fans through to the team and then in the boardroom as well.
Okay, right. Premier League action. Before we get into talking about any of the games, Blackpool, they've been fined today, just a couple of hours before we actually started recording this pod, so things might have changed by tomorrow morning, but they've been fined for fielding, I guess, what you call an understrength team, or the Holloway made a load of changes before the Villa game back in November, wasn't it? Or was it October? It's a while ago, some point last year. And they've been fined £25,000 for it. Holloway did initially, when this was first brought up last year, threaten to offer his resignation if the Premier League brought charges against him. They have now brought charges against him. James, what's your thoughts on the matter?
We discussed this back in November, and I said that the Premier League are barking up the wrong tree if they think that going after Blackpool is going to resolve the issue, if there is even an issue to resolve, of teams playing under strength starting 11s for Premier League games. Really, they should be going after the bigger sides who leave out whole starting 11s for big matches, and they should leave off someone like Ian Holloway. But to be honest, Ian Holloway's mad rantings recently have turned me, and actually I think a £25,000 slap on the wrist, perhaps not for resting some players, but just for just being a bloody idiot, might serve to shut him up for a few weeks at least, or perhaps at least until Charlie Adam and the transfer window is resolved.
That could be it. The Premier League probably aren't too happy with him either, so maybe it is exactly that. I think Blackpool have put out a statement lately, and I've got it in front of me, and it says that the team selection for the FA Cup game, which they lost to Southampton as well, has been taken into account. So, they've decided to build a case against him for whatever reason. But it's an absolute joke.
I mean, look, 25 grand, and who's going to pay for it? No, it's not Ian Holloway going to be dipping into his bank account.
He
for
might
that.
Do pay out of his Charlie Adam bonus, can't he?
Yeah. Well, so 25 grand, it's not even a slap on the wrist. It's just a light waft near him, near his wrist.
Or we have to cross the bowels.
Exactly. It's not going to make any difference, but unless incidentally Ian Holloway resigns come tomorrow morning, and we'll all look completely stupid. It will serve only just to sort of make him a little bit more cautious about speaking so openly about issues that he should really keep his trap shut about.
But so, I mean, Jess, you've got Premier League, they put in these squads of, say, 25 people in a squad. Yeah. That's who you can use for the course of the season. He's then used people from his 25 squad and they go, that's not good enough, you've got to use a different 11.
Yeah, I think it's quite unfair, actually. Contrary to some people around the table, I've always been quite a big fan of Ian Holloway. And I think, well, if he's done so well to bring the team on like this, and now they're saying, like, in order for him to compete realistically against these huge big teams that have very, very strong squads, you know, and they can't be accused of fielding a weakened 11 because they've got a strong 20. You know, I think it's in order for him to compete on any sort of level, you'd hope that he'd be allowed the same way to rotate squad.
No, I think genuinely we agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Well, I should say I remain a fan of Ian Holloway generally, but because he's Villa are the target of his ire at the moment. He's never going to win that with me.
Well, obviously, I mean, but just
I just think
it just smacks a bit. Really, it just seems a bit ridiculous. But then again, so much in the Premier League.
It's just pointless. This rule should have gone as soon as they. I mean, it shouldn't be there anyway, but it should have just been scrapped as soon as the 25-man squad was brought in. Simple as that. There's, okay, we'll change this. You now have your squad of 25. Do with that what you will. Rotate them. Change them for different games.
Yeah, we've told you to cut down on what you're doing. You now have. It's up to you how you use them.
They're not going to deal with the big clubs doing it. It's always going to be Wolves and Blackpool and teams like that. Things like that get punished.
I'll be honest, if they do want to punish Blackpool for anything this week, it's giving away a 2-goal lead at home against Manchester United and ruining the title race.
Well, hey, got on to that. That was a game and a half, though, wasn't it, James?
Oh, it was a fantastic game. Two £10 million worth of corners put Blackpool 2-0 up, and then Man United go and do what they've been doing for pretty much my entire lifetime. I'd just like to say I'm 26 years old, so some people with longer memories will probably remember the times when Man United were losing a lot, but all I can remember is Man United scoring 98th minute winners since time immemorial. So yeah, it actually seemed on the cards. I don't know why. I was watching the highlights and I didn't know what had happened, but you just felt that, didn't you? You just felt, oh, they're going to do it.
Yeah, there was a feeling as well. I mean, because I was obviously at the Arsenal while the match was being played, and obviously word gets around with a few smartphones that actually work. And but by the time everybody came out for half time, everybody headed for, like, a lot of people I know headed for the bookies because they just said, yeah, Man United 3-2. Because you could see it coming. No matter how happy we were at the time, you could just see it coming.
Sign of a champions, though, isn't it?
The only thing that would make me doubt that bet is the possibility of 4-2. That's the only reason.
Getting back into the I mean, that could be a win that's very, very important for the season, Chris, for Manchester United. Because, I mean, we talked about them possibly going unbeaten, which would be slightly ridiculous given how they performed to a certain point. But, you know, had they lost that or drawn that, you know, Arsenal, Manchester City gain a bit more ground, it just keeps that little bit of daylight there, doesn't it?
It does. It could be huge for them because, coming from behind at half-time as well, it shows that they do have the grit. They can grind out the results even quite a significant deficit in the game, and they've got strikers who are scoring goals, and that could be absolutely golden in this tight race, because, you know, if they don't kick on properly, then it's going to end up being quite tight. I think they're slightly a cut above the other candidates at the moment, not by much. They're not like Man United teams past, but they still have that funny Man United edge, and if the goal scorers are firing, that could be enough to help them out.
To a certain degree, I've staked my professional reputation as a football talker on Manchester United not going the season unbeaten. I still don't think they're going to do it. even after that, and that was a real close shave, and we're talking against Blackpool, who, well, everyone knows about Blackpool. No one would have given them a hope in hell, so I don't think that they're going to do it. They may still win the title. They probably are, on balance, the team, you know, best placed, kind of, generally. Although, I've said it before and I'll say it again, I still think Arsenal are going to do it. So you'll be pleased with that, right, Jen?
Yeah, I'll be a little pleased with it. I'll be honest, though, like, it's the unbeaten thing that is really getting under my skin a little bit at the moment. But I do think they've still got to play Chelsea twice, I think.
I don't even think it'll necessarily be Chelsea. Someone else will beat them.
Well, they've also got to come to the Emirates, but anything is possible there.
Mm. It must be quite galling, actually, for an Arsenal fan, because the two, if you compare the unbeatable Arsenal team,
yes, to the current Man United team,
it's just completely different teams.
It is, and that it is getting under my skin a little bit, but it's getting. I find it's kind of doing that to me more so than it is to any of my other Arsenal fan friends who are just like, there's no way they're doing it, and they've got this extreme level of confidence about it. So yeah, I'm keeping an eye on it.
Team, another team it's been a big week for is Villa, Chris.
Huge week.
Yeah, you've gone up 14th now, 27 points.
You dropped a place.
After last night. Sorry.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I've just ruined all your joy.
Dragged back into the mire.
But yeah, I mean, you know, Villa were in crisis just a couple of weeks ago. You now got a couple of wins, a few wins on the spin. Big win against Manchester City, but probably also you've got to say that the win against Wigan is just as important, that away victory at the DW.
Wigan was big. I think most of us would have taken 4 points out of those two games. To get six is just superb. Because Man City are a team that we have a lot of difficulty with in general. We've had a couple of good wins over them in recent years, but generally they tend to steamroll us, and they've done so this season. So unexpected victory there. Actually, that game couldn't have gone any better. I would much rather Darren Bent scored the goal he did than a 35-yard pile driver, because it just showed exactly why we've spent so much money on him. And there's a lot of talk about different motivations and different things going on in the lead-up to the transfer. And for me, it's just as simple as we have paid through the nose to plug a huge gap that we absolutely needed to sort out. And he's going to be worth every penny if he keeps us up.
Mm, absolutely. And how things change. Quick word, though, for the opponents, Wigan. Jess, Arsenal had Wigan at the weekend and, you know, routine 3-0 victory. Do you see them staying up? Because I think out of all the teams at the bottom, even West Ham, I think, might have a chance of climbing out there. But Wigan, to me, I can't see them staying up this season.
Yeah, there's a funny way about them, isn't there? They do seem to be just kind of hollow, in a sense. With a team like West Ham, you always feel that they have got this kind of, like we were talking about before briefly, that the idea of like treating every competition every game like a cup match. With Wigan, it just seems like they haven't got that sort of reserve, and they're not really that bothered. Which might be a bit harsh, really, but
certainly the way it comes across.
I think Wigan actually genuinely have got players with ability. They're a really good Championship team. Actually, they're just you're right in terms of, hollow is such a great word. Actually, there's nothing once you kind of gloss over the technical skills that the team obviously have. I mean, you look at I'm talking like Yordi Gomez or Tom Cleverley or whatever.
Even I was thinking, you know, Rodiega,
yeah,
and Zogbia, Figueroa. They're all very good footballers.
But you start to sort of knock at the structure a little bit, and it creaks and collapses, you know, like a pack of cards. So I don't know. I think they're probably actually, to sort of put a finer point on your point, Gary, they're probably the worst team in the Premier League, actually. But they're a good team, just not, they don't have the kind of assets that you need for a long, arduous Premier League campaign.
Because, I mean, I look down the bottom and, yeah, West Ham have been dreadful. I've seen them play absolutely terribly at points this season. But there's always, you just feel there's a potential that they could, if they really got things together, just about drag themselves clear. Wolves are a funny one, just that they play some lovely football at times, and for whatever reason it's not gone for them, and they're probably the second worst. But
I think that pitch at Molineux really is starting to harm Wolves. It looked awful. It looked awful the other day. And you know, Liverpool with their brand new late 80s style Kenny Dalglish trademark long ball game, it's starting to pay off. We're 3-0 winners at Molineux. But yeah, it's harming Wolves. Incidentally, Birmingham, just to pick up on another team that are down there, how important is losing Scott Dan for the season?
Huge for them, it really is.
Because they rely so heavily on their back four. I think they only conceded like 10 goals last season at home, maybe? I may have got that
sounds
wrong.
Sounds about right. They went on a very good run at home during that season.
And they only scored, they scored like 38 goals in 38 games last year. So really, they do massively rely on having a strong centre-back pairing. And to lose him for the run-in, that could be terminal for Birmingham. Well,
Curtis Davis's talk of him being swapped with Seb Larson.
Yeah, a strange move. How can you have players on loan from Villa to Birmingham? That'd be awful. It's a really funny one, because actually Liam Ridgewell, I think, is a slightly better centre-back than people give him credit for. But it just knocks the whole back four out of kilter to not have Dan, who's a better centre-back than him, in there. And it's going to make life very difficult for them. And Ridgewell does a job at left-back as well, and he'll be missed there. So it's going to cause them problems.
Mm. I can see Wigan definitely going down, and I can also see Birmingham going down unless they get another centre-back in.
Going back up to the top of the table, well, we've been talking about United potentially going unbeaten, Arsenal's wonderful run down the bottom, there's a lot to talk about there. Just Chelsea have kind of creeped back into a bit of form. That's 4-0 away at Bolton, that's not to be sniffed at.
No, it's really not, although they perhaps haven't had Bolton such like duck team for them. I think they've always been pretty great out there, haven't they? But yeah, I mean, it's a little bit unsettling. But to be honest, it's made things so much more interesting. Like the journey up to this point, that I kind of welcome it, so long as they
don't do too well.
Yeah, they don't. So long as they don't do too well, because they were very enjoyable to watch actually at Bolton, which is interesting because like historically, I've never been a fan of Bolton for some quite obvious reasons, but. Recently, they have been playing like incredibly well, and I think it was a bit of a shame. The result was a bit of a shame for them, really. Even though they couldn't match up to Chelsea, but it was still quite a good game.
Mm. That crisis over for Chelsea, or
I hope not. I'm sorry, anyone who listens who's a Chelsea fan, but I've really been enjoying Chelsea going through a kind of a period in which they're starting to actually question themselves, like what is their identity as a football club, like what are their expectations? You know, it's really shaking things up a bit. And
it's all got very existential down there, hasn't it?
It definitely has. You know, if Sarcher were alive today, probably Abramovich would bring him in as some kind of consultant.
Sarcher would surely go to Arsenal, wouldn't he? Because of the French connection.
New York Cosmos, isn't it?
All right, can I say Camus? Camus would have gone to Chelsea?
Yeah, fine.
They might do a kind of a swap deal at some point, like, you know, January window.
For Curtis Davis.
But yeah, either way, Chelsea are stopped being the machine, the bulldozer, the steamroller, or the large vehicle, and slowly become some kind of, you know, creaking, you know, aging kind of machine was actually an enjoyable experience, and I hope it...
I think it makes their matches all the more enjoyable to watch, really. So I remember settling in for the Sunderland match and thinking, I'm not really sure I want to watch this, and then afterwards obviously being unbelievably glad I did.
Less predictable.
Yeah, less predictable, and I think it does bring some, knowing that they're not a ridiculous superhuman team and they've got problems, it does make their matches all the more enjoyable.
Mm. One thing that I said, I mean, I think Chris might remember me saying this at the very start of the season. I said I fancy Arsenal for the title next season, and the reason I fancy Arsenal for the title next season is because by that stage, United would have declined, but Chelsea, you could see that their players, good players, were coming up to a point where they were going to start naturally dropping off because they were getting a bit older. they didn't quite have the reserves, and I thought it was going to be next season that we'd see them sort of fall over quite dramatically. So I was quite surprised that they've done it this early in the season. Yeah.
They've clearly got big plans for Kakuta, haven't they? Because they've got to farm him out to get some decent experience for the second half.
You mean like the way that they did with Franco Di Santo?
Yeah, that's true.
Sorry, just completely but they might, shat all over your
the difference
point.
Is they might need Kakuta to step up next season.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, likewise, Daniel Sturridge. What kind of a policy have they got for replacing Didier Drogba? They basically don't have one, do they?
Sign someone will be their policy.
I don't know.
There isn't anyone there.
No. I can't see it. And unless, you're right, unless Kakuta goes out, makes a name for himself, like the opposite of Franco Di Santo, or unless Daniel Sturridge suddenly starts caring about anything other than his wallet, then Chelsea is looking pretty terminal, actually.
And on that bombshell, we'll wrap it up there for the week on the pod. Very enjoyable one, as always. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you. Yes. Really enjoyed being back.
It's been great to have you back, even if you didn't bring back any breakfast with you.
Sorry, curryverse next time.
Actually. Oh, yes, please. Jess, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
No burgers either from your own.
Yeah, no burgers this time, I'm afraid. I couldn't bear to be able to carry one without eating it.
And James is a man who I don't even need to bribe with food because he graces us with his presence and we're all grateful for it.
I always love coming on the pod, especially when Chris is here, so I don't have to shoulder the full responsibility for sarcasm.
Thank you very much, dear listener. Just a few things to plug: www.2footedtackle.com. A few articles there. We've got a great one coming up in the next couple of days on Bologna. If Serie A's your thing, do go on there next couple of days. There's also some great stuff there on Leighton Orient, the Conservative Party in football as well. Go there, have a look. www.2footedtackle.com. Twitter.com/2footedtackle. That's Chris if you want to yell football-related stuff at him. Facebook.com/2footedtackle. Become a fan of the podcast. And have your say on various stuff on there. Podcast@2footedtackle. If you've got any mundane footballer anecdotes, please do send them in. Absolutely loving that, and we'd love to hear more of them. And most importantly of all, if you're going to visit one website this week, 2footedtackle.com/cry, and donate some money to Cardiac Risk in the Young, because we're raising money for them, and it'd be lovely if you could spare a bit of your change for us. Thanks very much. That's about it. See you next time.